The following talk was given by Jed Larson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 18, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a pleasure sitting with you. It's a nice intimate group. There's kind of a nice quiet with that comes along with having a small group, so I'm appreciating and enjoying that. The talk I came up with today has some parallels with what Steve was talking about yesterday. Just by chance, we didn't collaborate or anything. But what I'll be looking at here actually is every once in a while I go back and look at this. I think of it as like a treasure trove, basically, of Suzuki Roshi transcripts. If you go on the San Francisco website, it has transcripts of all the talks that were ever recorded by Suzuki, which I assume there's probably more talks than that that weren't recorded, but everything that was recorded on audio cassette or reel-to-reel, whatever they're using back then, is transcribed. And if you look down the list, it's got a breakdown of all those talks, and then it shows which talk is in a book. So you can see which ones are actually can be found in books. And you go down the list, and there's tons of talks that are not in a book anywhere. So I kind of dig through there every once in a while. And I was looking around for some commentary of Suzuki Roshi's on not specifically the Heart Sutra, but I found one where he talks about a line from the Heart Sutra. So I'll be looking at that. And I think, as most of you know, the Heart Sutra is focused pretty directly on the teaching of emptiness. So Steve talked about that a little bit yesterday. So that's part of what the talk is representing. So I thought I'd mention a line from the Heart Sutra that we're probably familiar with, since we chant it here. We've chanted it once to yesterday, and we will today as well. But the line is, when practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom, perceive that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress. So right at the beginning of the Heart Sutra there, you get this teaching of practitioner perceiving that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress. For me, that's maybe you don't hear that too much about emptiness and suffering. And actually, the understanding of emptiness is relief from suffering itself. As Steve was talking about yesterday, I believe, you're saying the teaching of emptiness can often seem pretty abstract, or maybe kind of philosophical, or it's hard to make sense of it. But here, right in the Diamond Sutra, we have this direct relationship between release from suffering and understanding of emptiness. I thought I'd just mention briefly, too, know of a sutra from the Pali Canon that in many ways is kind of like embryonic of the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra is a Mahayana sutra, so it would be much later than the Pali Canon. And I thought I'd just read this Pali Canon sutra, just a very short segment of it. And you can see the basis of the Heart Sutra right in this earliest of teachings from the Buddha. And this sutra is called "Empty is the World." The Buddha said, Because it is empty of self and what belongs to the self, it is thus said, empty is the world. What is empty of self and of what belongs to the self? The I forms consciousness, contact, feeling, forth. All of this is empty of self and what belongs to the self. So here you have a sutra that is very similar to how we see the Heart Sutra laid out, speaking of the emptiness of the five skandhas. And this, I think, is obviously a teaching that goes all the way back to the very beginning, and a teaching that helps us point our attention to the world itself. And Suzuki really gets into this in a way that I think has a flavor of portraying a world that is actually not rigid, that's not fragmented, that's not frozen. That's the world of experience. And that's what the teaching, this particular type of teaching, I think can speak to us. It's a type of teaching that portrays a way of understanding that we don't actually need to grasp after what is actually ungraspable. This world is completely inconceivable. So it's a teaching helping us, or reminding us, that we don't actually need to cling or grasp after anything. I thought I'd bring in an example just to start things out a little bit here, short example, just to touch on perhaps, again, kind of what Steve was saying. I believe that, you know, we can see this teaching of emptiness as being pretty abstract. And I think a big part of that, obviously, is it's being presented in words, concepts to us. You know, it's being described as an emptiness is, you know, however it's worded or whatever. And it's so different than what we're used to, we end up kind of sensing that it seems abstract or hard to understand. But really, it's just because it's so easy to kind of try to grasp onto those ideas to understand what is being pointed out here. But anyway, this example would be of a simple tree that we may see outside, or if we're out on a hike somewhere. And the teachings, in a lot of different ways, have a lot of tips for us to understand the world of appearances, the world of phenomena. Teachings like, we can think of a lot of different things, how these things, this phenomena that's showing up in the world is constantly changing. It's impermanent. The teaching of how we begin to understand how thinking is limited. So my idea about this tree can't capture what is actually happening. And of course, we recognize that, or we sort of reflect on what that is to think about something. And then we recognize, of course, my concept is different than, you know, what's showing up. So we'll hear teachings about the map as being different than the terrain. Or in other words, the word that we have for something is, you know, that's not the word if we're looking at a tree. So we kind of are hearing these different ways of sort of switching things up a little bit for how we, or to maybe address our assumptions about permanence and so forth. So we'll hear these things And then, we'll say, of course, the tree is not a word. You know, it's limited and so forth. But then I think there's still something like, but still there's something there. You know, even though I can't name it, even though it's constantly changing, there's still something, you know, there's this kind of feeling of outside and inside. There's still something, even though it's constantly moving, super speed. But I would say to that is that's not exactly what's happening. You know, there's this tendency of, there's something, you know, something, I can't explain it, but there's something out there. There's something that exists. And in conjunction with that, another quick example of if you picture yourself as just thirsty and, you know, sort of a thought experiment, and you don't know how to quench that thirst, you would get an instruction just to taste the water. You know, so just a very simple thought experiment. And so we feel this thirst, and I'll bring these two stories together in a second, but we feel this thirst, we get the instruction that to taste the water, and then that just totally makes sense to us. You know, we think, of course, water quenches our thirst. You know, so we are hearing this instruction, and it just really makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, a lot of ways these teachings we hear about impermanence or emptiness, they make a lot of sense to us, or they can at times. And, but if we hang on to just the idea of water quenches thirst, it's at some point going to feel abstract too. And actually, that's not what I said initially. I said just taste the water was actually what the instruction is. It's not water quenches thirst. So we'll kind of get into the intellectual mode and hang on to that idea. But what I hope to touch on here, and I think what Suzuki really gets at is in understanding emptiness, it literally is just the so-called tasting of water. So it can never be a teaching, actually. You know, if we're hanging on to the teaching can help us understand that the knowing of emptiness is just direct experience itself. So Suzuki Roshi, in this talk, is from 1969, a Thursday evening in November 13th. And the title of the talk is Form is Emptiness, Emptiness is Form. So I don't know. I don't think he titled his talks. I think maybe that was just attributed to it later. But in this talk, Suzuki Roshi, and just kind of scanning around other talks, it seems like he touches on this form as emptiness, emptiness as form theme quite a bit. I was seeing that in quite a variety of talks. But in this one, he says, similar to kind of what I was saying about direct experience, he says, when everything is in a state of emptiness, everything, you know, starts to appear in its true sense. So really understanding the world of phenomena is to understand emptiness in its true sense. And again, this is the drinking of water, what is fully direct, something that there's no question about. With a theory about emptiness, it's always going to be just kind of a formulation of some kind. The understanding of emptiness is direct. Suzuki Roshi says, to realize or to experience emptiness of self is to practice Zazen. So again, bringing us back to the practice itself. which, you know, just slow down for a second and you think about it. What is immediate? Practice is immediate. There's no intermediary. This is a direct thing that he's talking about. He says, in actual everyday life, the experience of oneness of objective and subjective world, when you attain enlightenment, it is like, just like this, and then he taps his stick on the table. So the oneness of objective and subjective, so he's talking about emptiness, even, you know, what seems like solid, this is actually the truth of what is the complete, vibrant world. Suzuki goes on and says, emptiness is form. It is a very logical discernment, but it is not just logical. So I think he's here referring back to the ways that we can study different Buddhist teachings, you know, be it emptiness or whatever it might be. There's a way of laying this out so we can begin to understand what impermanence or emptiness is. So he says it's a very logical discernment, but it is not just logical. It is more based on our actual experience of everyday life. He says, not special teaching, you know, not some teaching which can be approved, let's see here, but that which can be experienced by practice through everyday life. So not some special teaching or something that can be approved or disapproved. Actual practice, or what does he say here? Only experienced by practice through everyday life. Which I think is pretty good news, you know, to actually understand the truth of reality. How else would you want to understand it other than what is absolutely direct and beyond question, which is taking a sip of water or out in nature, seeing the tree just gently move in the breeze. There's nothing that needs to be said about it. It's fully expressing without any question. So emptiness is this full activity, this expression of nature as it is. Suzuki uses a couple of images here, very lovely images, in his usual very graceful way he has. In this case, the image of the sky and the things in the sky could be a bird or another part of the talk here. I think he talks about the plants growing up out of the ground and they're kind of entering the sky. So Suzuki says, the sky doesn't discriminate things. This sky in which many things exist. I should say here, I think the term sky is somewhat representative of emptiness here when Suzuki's talking about it. So the sky does not discriminate things. And he goes on and says, various beings are quite free in the big sky. But our mind is not so. He says, I like this. I don't like this. It's a little bit different than this open sky. Another, so I'll just let that be, and I'll talk here about another image that he has. and uses the example of parents and children. And when I'm reading through this, I'm kind of like editing as it goes, because there's a whole lot of you knows in there. He's which is, when you listen to the talks, it's quite beautiful, because he'll be saying, and then I'll say, you know? And he's saying that we do know, I think. He's asking whether we know, but he knows that we know. But the grammar in here is just, it's pretty interesting. So he says, in our family, you know, the children are all a part of what the parents are. And parents treat them, the children, as they treat their own hands and feet. So actually, children are a part of parents. Suzuki says, the children have no idea of parents, but actually that is parents. When they have no idea of children, they're actually really parents. You know, if parents has some idea of parent, then they are not parents. And the imagery here, I think, at least how I was seeing it, is this is a talk, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And the children, parents, emptiness, form. It's very easy to think, okay, there's form and then there's emptiness. Or, you know, there's children, there's parents. They're just, you know. The words will, you know, just innately insist that those things have to be in their own camp. And this, again, kind of this elegant portrayal of course, you know, what's children exclusive of parents? It just doesn't make sense. They come, this is together. This is the same. So form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. This is the same. When he's tapping on the table, this is the true form of form. And to say it's emptiness is the same exact thing. So we recognize emptiness, and in recognizing emptiness, without needing to think about it, is just to recognize the world originally free from separation. So the ideas that we come up with, they just naturally, in order to communicate, that's how words work. They just have to, again, insinuate separation. That's the way concepts work. But here, recognizing emptiness is actually understanding this original non-separation. From the very beginning, this is not a fragmented world. So we can think about a tree, but actual direct experience shows us what is truly seamless. And that's part of, obviously, what our practice is. You know, we take the time to sit and hear the sound or the sight without needing to think about it. Suzuki goes on, you know, I'm just kind of pulling some different quotes from this talk, although it's a pretty short talk, which I don't know if it was a short talk or if they only caught part of it. He must have done really short ones too, I'm not sure. I don't know. Did you hear much about? Let's see. You've studied with one of Suzuki's direct disciples. Did you hear about Suzuki much? Yeah, probably quite a bit of examples, huh? Yeah. Maybe a little later, if you think of some stuff, you can chime in during questions and answers. But so Suzuki says also, when there's no idea of anything, that is big mind. That is emptiness itself. So when there is no idea of anything, that is big mind. That is emptiness itself. That's this big sky. So here, Suzuki is saying, I think, when views just naturally drop away, then there's no view of the rigid, any rigid world at all. So thinking drops away, and just naturally you have this fluidity, non-substantiality, just as it is. So once again, Suzuki is bringing us back to experience. And it doesn't really matter whether we're thinking or not. All we have to do is just come back to this. And naturally, the world can, I mean, right when we bring our attention back, here we are. And then the world is as it is. We don't need to do anything. We're continually coming back. So this is just another example of Suzuki Roshi, I think, pointing us back to experience. And there's some kind of funny things about when you reflect on what it is to live out of ideas, or maybe kind of just a bit of honesty with how our energy is spent a lot of the time when we are thinking about things. Yeah, just in the sense that it's instructive to recognize the limits of thinking. So I brought up the example of a tree. And if you have ever tried this, unless you're an artist who has actually practiced this, this doesn't work. But if you just sit down on a piece of paper and you want to draw a tree, for most of us, it's going to be like kind of like a fluffy cloud-looking thing with the sticks hanging out the bottom. Exactly. Which is kind of a way to sort of laugh, you know, at ourselves a little bit, because compared to what's going on in the world, it's kind of like, is that the best that we can do? Because I was just noticing, and I'm in this camp too, but I noticed the other day, there's a couple different tree varieties outside here. So I'll end with the grand queen of the whole yard here. But there's a hackberry. There's some hackberry trees out front, and then a maple. And those branches go from the tree, they go up, and then they sort of swoop down. In case you have to draw a hackberry tree. Or over here you have some spruce, the evergreen trees. In those branches, they essentially come straight out of the tree, but then they drop down slightly. And then the maple is like the hackberry, the tree. The branches go up and then swoop down. And then, as I mentioned, the queen of all, the queen of the forest in Minnesota is the white pine, the grandest of all trees, in my opinion. And those branches, they often come out straight from the tree, but then they swoop up kind of slightly at the ends. So you see that sort of almost like elevating type of feel to it. and it towers over every other tree too. But so here, this is a teaching of an invitation to experience and to appreciate this original emptiness, which is how everything shows up in its huge amount of variety. So it's kind of a way into noticing all the different things that may be just kind of, we don't, you know, we may place a little more importance on our ideas, so we kind of just don't pay attention as much as we can. But of course we can at any time that we want. And Suzuki Roshi says, as we go on, he says, let's see here. So you see, when your zazen is very good, you know, if a bird comes and, you know, sings, the world of the bird appears. This endless world appears. So we get these examples of teachers reminding us of what Suzuki calls real form, or the form of form, which is actually emptiness here. So he's encouraging us, I think, to, he says, when your zazen is very good, then this itself is to understand the world as it is in its vibrancy. It's and that we can dedicate ourselves to that, you know, come back to this moment. Really, it's a true opportunity each moment. There's another story that came to mind. Steve mentioned yesterday of a Zen master from antiquity who used a piece of firewood and strapped to the leg of his chair. The chair broke and strapped a piece of firewood on there. And that was the Zen master Joshu. And he's, I presented a class on a lot of the koans. Actually, they're just interactions between his students. Both monks and nuns would come to him and present a question. And it's interesting when you read through a lot of them, it'll be a lot of the same question, which is, you know, normal. The same question would come up. And then he answers in a way, and then he'll answer in a similar way to a different question or the same question from somebody else. But it'll just have, you know, it's almost like a variation of Mozart. You know, it's just slightly different, but it's kind of, it has its own beauty. It's almost completely different. And this one is similar to one that you may have heard, but it's just slightly different. When the person asked, what is truth? I think you could say, what is emptiness? You can put anything in this place. What is the ultimate nature of reality? And Joshu says, he hears the question and he says, well, do you know the front, the oak tree in the front courtyard? And that's the end of the interaction. Well, it's a little bit different than another one. He says it is the oak tree in the front courtyard. But this one he says, well, do you know the oak tree in the front courtyard? Is the question, which I think communicates almost like a childlike curiosity or something, You know, just, well, do you know? He knows that you know about the, you know, the white pine. So that's the question that we ask ourselves. Do I know it? Yes, of course. But it's not, it's nothing that can be framed up or boxed up in any way. This experience, the knowing of experience, is not according to some kind of solidified or specific explanation. It's just experience. So Joshua asks. He doesn't explain anything because nothing can be explained. Suzuki also says here, so the first part is he explains, if a bird comes and sings, the world of the bird appears, this endless world, and says, because of the one bird, we feel the complete calmness of the whole mountain. When the one bird enjoys the whole world, this is complete calmness. This is real calmness. This is real emptiness. And that is real form of form. So if I say the lectern is like an object that's different than the cup, that's completely based on ideas, or, you know, that's very closely associated to ideation. But Suzuki here is talking about, he's talking directly. So he's saying when the bird shows up, this is, as he says, the complete calmness of the whole mountain. That's actually what the bird is. Bird is not a separate bird. And this is the real form of form. So the budding of that little tree out in the forest, that's actually but what is always happening is this complete functioning of emptiness as it is. That's exactly what the world is. So what we do is just to pay close attention. There's like kind of a question, you know, how do we recognize this, or what do we do? So the instruction is just to pay close attention, and it's to, I think, kind of get a feeling which can sort of maybe energize our sense of practice towards a sense that this is just to taste the water. You know, we can hear the teaching, you know, it's written down in words to understand what it's saying, but to kind of feel this energy of actually paying close attention. I'd mentioned before, I think in a talk, about how it seems like meditation sort of has the kind of feeling that it's to maybe sort of transform something, or it's meant to do something specific, which is kind of interesting to think and reflect on that a little bit. But actually, I think these teachers are saying that the sitting practice can have the same energy or feeling of just experience. And I thought of, like, if you're out looking at a tree in nature, you're not thinking, well, I'm learning how to see a tree. Or, you know, like kind of meditation can have that inflection a little bit. I'm doing this to kind of change something. You don't look at a tree and think, well, I'm doing this to kind of change anything. It's just experience. So this type of paying attention or just tasting the water is the energy we put forth in meditation, which is actually more good news because it's very simple. You know, we can actually just sit, and sometimes we'll hear the sound of leaves rustling, or but it can be frustrating too because we reduce distractions to a bare minimum in session. So it's kind of like the different things that we can kind of play with or that occupy our minds in different ways is not there. So it's a little bit of a, you know, it's not the easiest thing in the world. But actually, that bare minimum in itself is, I think, just kind of a, it's actually kind of like a kind environment because it's helping us. You know, if we were just had things to distract ourselves with, it wouldn't necessarily be that helpful. You know, it would make it harder for us in a way. So what seems maybe a little bit frustrating, the things that are frustrating about sitting are actually supportive aspects. And of course we can feel the support of the other practitioners and this deep history of teaching, Suzuki's eloquent examples. And the same thing with seeing form, yeah, whatever form it might take, this true form of form can actually just be a warm reassurance that this actually is the complete functioning of emptiness. So whatever we see, it's not actually fragmented and frozen. And I think emptiness is a tricky teaching in a lot of ways because it does seem sort of technical or something. But so I've always tried to guide myself towards seeing the teaching of emptiness more with in light of freedom, that this is actually freedom from substance or rigidity, and also it ties in with recognizing the freedom aspect of this is also kind of this warm recognition that reality can be exactly what it is in its huge amount of variety, and then also an opening for compassion too. Emptiness is a teaching that also helps us, brings a bit of light onto the things where we get ourselves in a little bit of trouble. So usual perspectives can be that this person is like this, this person is like this, and this is all based on solidified views of different people. You know, the judgments and the valuations that we come up with. And, you know, it's understandable that that happens because we're using language. We have to use language to navigate the world, to communicate with people. But then we'll fall into error, you know, accidentally or however you want to describe it. Just because it's, you know, there's sort of a pull to want to control things or just, you know, tweak things and the different things that we do. But then the teaching of emptiness is saying that we can actually open the hand of thought again. We don't have to insist on our ideas, which I think, at least for me, is a helpful way to maybe catch myself before I make that judgment about the other person or insist that something be a certain way, or that kind of a bit of a magnetic pull of wanting to try to control something a little bit. So it's the teaching of emptiness. And maybe there's a different word for it. I haven't quite thought of one, you know, like non-rigidity or something like that, where we can hear that teaching and just sense flexibility as a part of what emptiness is. There's a fascicle by Dogen. I'll just talk about a couple other references here, since I brought up the topic of emptiness. That it might be helpful just to bring in a couple other, or to talk about Dogen just slightly or very briefly, and then we'll end it with another quote from the Buddha. This particular fascicle by Dogen is called Space, or Tana is the original, T-A-N-A is the fascicle. It's a short one. And Dogen starts this out by saying, provoked by the question, what is right here, the way actualizes. So provoked by the question, what is right here, the way actualizes. The question of what is right here. Normally we would, you know, explain that as the different components of our environment, you know, the collection of how whatever it is. So here, the world shows up is an invitation to ask what actually is going on. And in asking what's going on, we find in this instantaneous or constantly manifesting present moment, actually it's actualizing. So right at the moment of asking the question, what is this? Dogen is saying, this is actualizing. We ask a question thinking that, okay, somewhere down the road I'll get that, but Dogen's saying, provoked by the question, what is right here, the way actualizes. That's what we find actualization. He says that there are 84,000 types of emptiness and more. He says, expounding the Heart Sutra is done with empty space. When we expound or we chant the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra is expounding because all this is just actualization. You know, the reality is showing up exactly as it is. He says the Heart Sutra, expounding the Heart Sutra, is done with empty space. And in kind of classic Dogen, in his classic way, I think pretty much anything that you run across in terms of writing by him has this quality of, what would the word be? Completeness or not lacking anything. So he'll say that, or there'll be kind of maybe older ways of teaching that we find further back in time where there'll be examples of dust in the world being like confusion, which is a helpful thing, you know, to understand how confusion arises. But then Dogen later will say, what dust is not the great mirror? The great mirror, or the great, or what dust is not reality already? So even if confusion arises, Dogen's communicating this with a feeling of completeness. And again, here we see this expounding the Heart Sutra is done with empty space. So what we actually have as this chant is happening is complete, thoroughgoing, just the empty nature of what, you know, emptiness. And let's see here, he says, continues, he says, now the person who faces the wall meets the wall that faces the person. This is the world of space. And if it wasn't clear already, he's using the term space, not how we would scientifically think of space, but space is, he's expressing this, I think, in a way that we would hear emptiness being expressed, not just an empty void or something. So I'll reread that. He says, now the person who faces the wall meets the wall that faces the person. This is the world of space and is equally bringing forward things of emptiness. That's the other, in my experience, non-stop quality of Dogen, is he's always talking about grasses, trees, tiles, and pebbles. He is like to the hilt, never denigrates like the physical world, and or never gives the impression at all to say that something is lesser or that it's kind of doesn't exist, or you know, whatever kind of confusion that we might have about what Buddhism is saying about, you know, we might assume that emptiness is talking about nothingness or that it doesn't exist. So that's kind of a warmth that I feel too in Dogen, that he is like Suzuki, you know, tapping or saying the pebbles, trees, just like Suzuki is saying, tapping on that wood with his wood stick and saying, you know, do we want to find emptiness? It's, you know, this, we don't have to look far. So tiles, trees, pebbles, here he says, the person facing the wall meets the wall facing the person, and all is equally bringing forward things of emptiness. You know, it could be even thoughts that are arising in our mind during meditation. And it's funny, we kind of, you know, just in the everyday life, we sort of, we can think of things as quite permanent. But in some ways, our ideas of thoughts can be pretty permanent too, because it's almost like, I want this to stop, you know. You know, if you just really felt you wanted it to stop, there's something to stop, you know what I'm saying? So, if there wasn't anything, you know, if there's something kind of vaporous about it, you wouldn't be probably so insistent that you wanted thinking to stop so badly. But here, again, we have this kind of warmth or a feeling. The thoughts drifting through like clouds are actually okay. This is bringing forward things of emptiness in this case. You know, it would be sitting and these things of emptiness, of true emptiness, are appearing, fading in and out. There's actually nothing behind them. It's true reality, though. So, in session where we have our distractions to a bare minimum, and as a result, this opportunity opens up. Dogen says, the person facing the wall and the wall are equally things working together as this seamless emptiness. And I wrote down what Steve used the phrase. think it's pretty much exactly what Dogen's saying. Steve, at the beginning of his talk, said, what we do is an expression of emptiness. So I think this is what Dogen is saying. Dogen also says, being used by the 12 hours of the day, and using the 12 hours of the day is when you realize space. So being used by the 12 hours of the day and using the 12 hours of the day is when you realize space. So it's not just us using the 12 hours of the day, going out and doing upon that which is outside. This is Dogen saying, being used by the 12 hours of the day. So this complete functioning, but we can't ignore how we navigate the hours that we're awake. We have a responsibility to do what we are doing in the world, to use thinking responsibly as much as we can, to try to find compassion in how we use concepts and ideas to navigate. So if we are just using our 12 hours of the day on the world out there, that is not realizing space. Dogen is saying that the child and the parent has to be seen as non-different. And then when that's understood, this is when we realize space. So this is all based, or kind of inspired by the Heart Sutra, again, that line, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. So everything that I've been talking about, you know, when we hear that in the Heart Sutra, I think, we can potentially see it with the same spirit of Suzuki talking about the bird, the endless world showing up in the sky, the sky not obstructing anything, that form does not differ from emptiness. That which is emptiness is form. And just to wrap it back to that first quote from from the Heart Sutra also, when we hear, practicing deeply the perfection of wisdom, perceive that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering and distress. The Buddha has another, I found another passage from the Pali Canon, and this one is entitled, Impermanence in Not Self. Yeah, let's see here. The Buddha is bringing this up in conjunction with this line, save from all suffering and distress. So that's, like hearing about emptiness, we can see that it's actually a very soft term, that it's talking about release from suffering. It's not a technical, sort of philosophical thing at all. And then the Buddha's talking about the well-taught, noble disciples, the bhikkhusus and bhikkhus, the nuns and monks practicing. The Buddha says, being disenchanted by form, the practitioner becomes dispassionate. For dispassion, their mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. So just a very short passage there. So being disenchanted with material form. This is, I think, a referring us back to the sort of enchantment or almost a bit of like an entrancement that we can have with words. And we can end up being pretty invested in our concepts and ideas. And not that that's actually bad at all. That's what we wake up to. So when that happens, and it happens to everybody, no matter how long you've been practicing this, I think there's always going to be like stub the toe moment or like driving. If you're ever questioning it, just get in a car and go on the freeway, I guess. If you think you're the perfect practitioner, you'll be reminded that we become entranced. Yeah. And so this enchant, he says, becomes disenchanted. So this enchantment or this entrancement for me is like a tree is just a tree, you know. It's just like this thing, you know. But this is a way of like feeling that, of course, life is just, it's not generic. So being disenchanted with material form is just like a freedom of seeing through the generic kind of assumptions that we have. Lisa's got to, see you later, Lisa. She's got to head out of town to catch her.
I'm so sorry.
No problem. You got a train to catch, so.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, great to see you. So an invitation to just kind of, and it's not something we need to be taught. It's just like, of course, this world is not generic. It's to feel that on session we have this opportunity, obviously, and it's an opportunity just to be compassionate with maybe a busy mind or physical pain that's coming up, and really try to take care of our situation. We're here together. It's encouraging to see people supporting each other in the practice. And, you know, just letting this be a gentle practice. I think it can be, even though there can be difficulties that come up. If those thoughts are coming up and arising, we can just see them as Suzuki's talking about the bird in the sky. You know, actually, thoughts don't obstruct anything. They come and go. That's it. There's no true ultimate obstruction there at all. And if we just kind of come back to that, just continually, and it's, I think, amounts to just reminding ourselves to just come back to the breath. And in doing that, we'll just end up seeing face to face these thoughts that are coming through, arising and ceasing. And just through that diligence, then at I think, again, it's the opportunity that sort of grabbing at something vaporous just does not feel compelling, you know? It doesn't work by saying, I want to stop those thoughts. But actually, when we can see that it's okay, thinking is just fine, and we don't need to stop anything because there's nothing solid there to begin with. So reaching out, trying to get things to be this way or that, just is not compelling anymore. But that only is a function of just coming back to the truth of, you know, the sound or the light on the wall. That's direct. It's beyond question. And that's what dispassion is too, just an even-mindedness that can come about of its own accord. I like, he says, realizing this, when it is liberated, it's the recognizing that it is liberated. This is actually beyond any sense of self at all. It's just liberation. And this knowing is a knowledge that this is, of course, just this natural essence of what reality is. It's what it always is, what it always has been. It's like the big sky that obstructs nothing, the sky that Suzuki was giving us in his imagery. That's all I have for my talk. I don't know if any questions or observations came about by any of the material there. You have any good Suzuki Roshi stories? We're definitely up for it. So you studied with Bill Kwong. Does he go by Bill?
Kwong Roshi.
Kwong Roshi, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh. It's like so much a part of my world in a way. And I almost feel like his teachings are at a level more advanced than where they're so simple, they're kind of, they don't always click for me the way other teachers do.
Sure.
Even though I know the way I've received the teachings from the students, I feel like that's my main.
Yeah. I think Suzuki is almost like being taught by a tree or something, you know, where it's, you almost are just soaking in the, it's not really explanatory, or it doesn't explain things like some teachers do in very great ways. But yeah, I agree, it's it's eloquent. Suzuki's teachings are eloquent, and he does mention, I think, in several cases that what he's saying is just meant as an encouragement to practice, which I think it is, as a feeling of encouragement. It's almost like, in not explaining things too much, he knows that Zazen is the true teacher. So if he can provide something that's that sort of makes it resonate, that we feel that, yeah, there's something to this, then we might sit the next whatever it might be, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, one day.
It's in the moment of health, but like realness.
Mm-hmm. And then the next day, somebody asks you what the talk is about, and you're just kind of like, I don't, I can't. It was great, but I can't. Yeah.
Whenever I come back from Shishin's or whatever, my wife's like, well, how was Shishin? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't drop anything. it's hard to express it. It just was the experience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also see that I make it a little game with myself. Whenever I get out of the tradition, I think, okay, how long before I get pissed off by a driver?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You don't want to set the record there. It's like,
right.
You want it to, yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
I like the two talks that are about rebirth and connection. And so I haven't sat a session in 10 years probably because I was cooking and then there was COVID and whatever. And so coming back on flesh and on who's not here who used to be here, you know, and I miss them. And I'm also that age where that's what happens. People start disappearing. And so then I can get really sad about that. And yet, then you bring in this talk about Suzuki, who is still here when you talk about him. Dobin's still here when you talk about him. They're all still here. They're all still here. We're always coming and going. It's really encouraging, very encouraging to me to you know, that you go back to Suzuki talks and then you guys come to session, because there wouldn't be a session if we didn't come, right? So they aren't just ghosts. I was beating myself up for a while about, you know, why are all these ghosts showing up and they're ghosts? They're not, right? Okay, doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a thing. They don't have to be a thing. So, thanks.
Thank you. That is a great reminder that this touches on our everyday life, where we can feel what our grandparents are, you know, just as we take a step.
I even fleshed on that because my son had asked me for some genealogy brief, and I got this genealogy that goes like back to the 1600s. So I was looking at all these things, and I know my grandfather died 100 years ago this year, and so I was looking at what date it was. It was April 19th. So it was, I really felt connected to him, even though I never met him. He was dead like 40 years before I was born. So, but you're right. They're all right here. They're all, and yeah.
We have such a strong sense of time, and you can feel how, without, and I think about Suzuki and Dogen and stuff like that, but it's almost like when I think about all the monks and the nuns from the past upheld this practice, it's, I really appreciate these teachings, but there's something very, kind of like, I don't know, just almost emotional in a way, where it's like I appreciate all that effort for the people just who are never, they're not recognized, their names are, you know, we don't know their names anymore or whatever, but and then like the work that you have done in the kitchen and so many other people, the people at home who are supporting our practice, and it's... Yeah, yeah. It was Randy today, and then David, Amy, Catherine. So it's I try to remind myself that these teachings are talking about everything that comes up in life, and then trying to remember that these teachings are at their heart meant to remind us that yes, we can feel that appreciation for things of all time, all times, and all beings that support this practice. So yeah, thanks for that.
Which translation of yoga was that?
That was Ta-Nehisi, I think. Yeah, I think so. One of the translations used emptiness, the word emptiness, more than another one didn't use like a different word or something. But yeah.
And then the Suzuki archive is a lot of sort of well-trod paths, you know, Gendo Koan and Fascals like that, or some, is there some more dark horse deep cut Teishos on stuff in the archive?
There is not a ton of commentary you'll find the Blue Cliff record in there a little bit. It seems like a lot of his talks are more free form. I mean, he's got the Sandokai, there's a whole book on that, and it seems like he's kind of picking up on stuff more in a miscellaneous way. So it's a lot of variety. Some of it's, it's a whole range of different stuff. Some of it in there is you can never put that in a book. It's more instructive about robes or something like that. But there's one section, three different talks, which I presented on the way-seeking mind. So it's not specific to anything, but a particular teaching, but it doesn't draw on anything. But yeah, you should check it out. And the Katagiri Roshi, there's a whole archive of that as well. And that's a little bit more on specific fascicles and stuff like that.
You have heard the Suzuki story. It's not much of a story, but I heard it. It's on YouTube. There was two talks that Tom White, who was on Kosher Gem, was still living students who just translated a new book by Kosher Uchiyama, which is on a couple of fascicles. Oh no, I think it's just one on the last fascicle in Shogun. It's quite good. And his personality comes out. And I feel like, Nancy, to your point, Kosher Uchiyama is somebody you feel like you know him, because he has so many of these anecdotes about his life, some of which are strange and interesting. But so this was a celebration of Kosher Uchiyama, centenary or I don't know, but somebody said to Kosher Uchiyama over the Suzuki Roshi, and Tom White said, you would know the date better than I would. I can't remember, 70 or 71 when Suzuki died. And it was late in the year, I think it was December, and probably knowing that he was going to die, he went to go visit Japan. And so it was in the fall of that year, and he went and met Kosher Uchiyama. Tom didn't have any details in there. Had a beer or whatever, but he went and he didn't give a talk. I don't know if he was ill or whatever, but he just came to a Q&A. So he went and said, "Listen, guys, I don't have anything to prepare, but if you have any questions, I can try and answer them." Tom didn't go into anything there.
Suzuki,
and he said, Suzuki said that he liked Taiji and had great respect for Kosher Uchiyama. And I thought it was interesting, Tom said if Kosher Uchiyama had any take on Suzuki, and the other thing he said, he was great, but he wished he had more Japanese students. And I assume that just goes to how, relative to what has happened since, then in the United States versus Japan, just the flourishing here versus sort of maybe the deprivation in Japan, aside from,
Uchiyama wished he had more?
Uchiyama wished Suzuki had more.
Oh, okay. Knew about him, yeah.
Because, most of his, at least latter teaching was in the U.S. But
yeah.
I thought that was interesting. Who knows what they talked about?
Yeah, I heard that Suzuki wasn't really recognized in Japan. They didn't know until later. They're like, "Oh, this is a big deal," after he died. And then they paid more attention to Katagiri at that point. But yeah, I also heard that Suzuki, somebody said that somebody who knew Japanese and English said that Suzuki was maybe even better in English because it really made him. Have you heard something like that? Yeah, which is pretty neat too to think. That his, I can totally see the beginner's mind where he's just looking at words for the first time and thinking about them in very curious ways that we may not necessarily do as native speakers. But yeah, pretty magical stuff. So, yeah, thanks for that story. All right, it's great sitting with everybody. And
thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.